Space Burgers, and welcome to the Space Cave. A big warg to all of you. Hope things are going well. Junk show coming up Valentine's Day, February 14th at the Copper Still in Los Angeles. Hope to see you there. Let's check in with a Planet Earth citizen.
Hello?
Hi, is this Ambrose?
Hi, yes, this is. Is this David?
It is. Good ear.
Thanks. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. It sounded like your phone was hidden under your couch or something.
Close. I was plugging in my wireless Bluetooth so I could talk to you. Hands-free.
Oh, being safe. Good. That's paramount. Hello. How's it going?
It's going. I just left from doing a little shopping with my married couple friends in Arizona.
Oh, okay. 910, is that Arizona? I thought 602 was
Arizona.
No.
910 is North Carolina. It's like Wilmington area.
Oh, okay.
On the coast. I actually just got to, I flew cross country to LA last week, and then I came to Arizona for the weekend to get with them.
Oh, well, so you're just on a vacation, just visiting Arizona.
I'm sort of... yeah, I guess so. I'm sort of auditioning places to live.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I eventually figure it out.
I see. Okay. What, if you don't mind my asking, what age are you?
I am age 26.
Age 26. A wonderful age. We're very progressive in the way we talk about one another's age. I was just curious, like, have you had enough of Carolina? Are you just getting out of some sort of schooling? What's next for you?
No, I finished my schooling a couple of years ago. I'm kind of over Carolina. I grew up there. That's what I'm trying to figure out, what's next for me, as far as what I want to do for work and where I want to live. I put all my things in storage for the past year. I've been sleeping on friends' couches or in our spare rooms or at hotels.
Cool. That's pretty fun. Yeah. I did that when I was on the road all the time early on in stand-up. It wears on you after a bit, but a year is pretty... You're in the sweet spot.
Yeah, it's definitely a little exhausting, and I don't have, like, all my necessities with me, like my shoes, a good pair of heels, or a solid pair of flats. That's what I've been searching for. LA and Arizona, I still haven't found them, so...
Yeah, I know, like, books and things, when people go on adventures and they pare down their belongings, they're always sort of remorseful that they didn't bring more solid flats and high heels. You're going to want to have a good selection. Yeah. If you just had a backpack with just the bare essentials, you got to throw in some high heels and then maybe some snacks.
Definitely. And I have my dog with me, so that's, like, a whole other thing. Like, I try to pack as light as I could, but... Packing light for me this time, which is good, was two suitcases I checked, and then my dog, and then my backpack.
Whoa, crazy. What size is your dog?
He's like 11 pounds. He's a Chihuahua mix.
Oh, okay. So,
yeah, he's not like too cumbersome, but he's, I don't know.
Yeah,
you know,
still.
With his snacks and his food and everything and his little backpack.
Yeah. Well, you tweeted and said, hey, if you're still doing the calls, let me know. And so I'm curious, like, what predicated that? I saw that your Twitter is like has something to do with makeup. Are you an aspiring makeup artist?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I do. Like, I like to think of myself as sort of like a dilettante. Like, I'm kind of good at a lot of different things, but I like makeup. I went to school part of my schooling was for makeup, and then my degree was in nonfiction writing, so I do writing. But for actual work, like for money, so I can do the things I want to do, I'm a dancer. So that's how I'm able to travel
Oh, cool.
And do all these different things. Yeah.
Wonderful.
So that's part of the reason why I'm in Arizona this weekend, because my girlfriend told me that it's good. Like, their quote-unquote season is January and February.
There's a dancing season in Arizona?
There's a dance season in a lot of places. Yeah, and so that is what I'm working on, like, figuring out where to go and when. And it's a little stressful, but it's been interesting, and especially getting to see all these different places. Yeah. I've never been on the West Coast before, so.
Yeah, well, you're technically in the West. You're not really on the West Coast, but you're headed that direction.
Well, I was on the West Coast last week, and that's where I'm staying with my girlfriend. She has a boat out there. I'm just here for the weekend to check it out.
Oh, cool. Yeah, we're kind of similar in that almost being like a troubadour, a traveling, not really selling snake oil, but you're kind of like looking for a place to practice your craft, and you go kind of town to town for that. Like, is that how it feels? Like, you're just kind of out there making your way and going where there's, it's almost like being a prospector. Like, I heard there's gold in them hills, and then you head that way and try to paint a little.
That's what I feel like. And if you're in this business, it's all sort of word of mouth. So I'm trying to work on a website where it consolidates all the clubs for traveling dancers. There's a website for clubs for men to review as customers, but not one for dancers.
I see.
I think that would really help, because every club is so different. Like, people have no idea, but they're so different, and there's so many different rules, and you have to get a license at some clubs, and sometimes you don't.
So if it sounds like with the clubs, like, this is it more like exotic dancing, like for gentlemen?
Yes.
Oh, okay,
yes,
cool.
It is for gentlemen, preferably for gentlemen, but even riffraff get in, so.
And how do you find that nomenclature to sync up with that line of work? I always found, like, my estimation of gentlemen a little bit, like, they would be excluded from a place like that. I think of dudes in, like, Affliction t-shirts throwing money around with a lot of, like, piercings and slicked hair.
I'll tell you that if I see someone, I don't think I'm like most other dancers. I'm very bougie. I'm very mean.
You're mean?
I'm a very standoffish. Like, I'll sit at the bar. My form of hustling is sitting at the bar, and they'll come up to me. They know why they're there. If they want me, they want me. And if they don't, goodbye, and on to the next one. And if someone comes up to me and they're wearing Affliction and have really hard hair from gel and wearing flip-flops, it's like the main thing, like, never any flip-flops, then I just turn them down, because I have nothing in common with this person.
But you're there to, like, I mean, you're there to dance. You're not there to become their buddy. I thought that was kind of...
I am there for entertainment, but I can't entertain someone if I hate them. Or at least they hate their outfit.
Yeah.
It's a reflection of who they are, and I just don't have anything in common with them. Just like a nice, solid, button-down shirt, nice, thorn pants with some closed-toed shoes. That's all I'm asking for.
Yeah, so. That's, I mean, and again, they should not, they, I thought there was a dress code, because they are, in theory, trying to, yeah, they're trying to cycle out the people who are not gentlemen. Like, I'm sorry, sir, your gnarled toes and bunions hanging out of your feet are disgusting, and you don't look like a gentleman. I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
Right.
That seems reasonable.
Right, well, I think it also depends on the club, and that's another thing. Different clubs cater to different types of people. So I like a more upscale club where I have golfers or businessmen coming in.
Oh, wow. Well, I would like to talk more about this. Are you cool? Is it cool if we take a little quick break here, and then we'll continue this over? I have more questions, if that's all right.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, cool. Interesting. A part two, a continuation of the check-in. I've found that to be fascinating. Ambrose, thanks for calling in. We'll hear more from her next week. Now let's just get right into our guest, someone who has been on Professor Blastoff, the previous podcast I did. I think maybe the first guest who's a crossover, been on that show, and now on this one. I'm fascinated by the subject of neuroscience and just our brains, how they're wired up. If you've seen One-Headed Beast, there's a lot of content about that in there. That's on Vimeo On Demand, or you can get it at davidhunsberger.com. I'm a plug machine. There, you knew that. I went and saw a talk recently by this guy, Dr. Doige, cool name, Doidge, who's visiting Los Angeles, promoting a book and doing a bunch of talks about neuroplasticity And if you get a chance, check his stuff out. It's inspiring. It's how to rewire your brain. It tells stories and shows people learning how to sort of experience the world through different senses. So someone that loses sight, they'll like have this weird thing that sends this pulse onto their tongue, and then they can kind of see shapes. He talked about another person who had done research on their own father who had suffered a stroke, and the guy went and grabbed his dad when they said, "Hey, your dad had a stroke, he's going to die." He said, "Not on my watch," and taught his dad how to crawl and then walk and talk and do everything again until his dad ended up passing away mountain climbing. And then when they did the autopsy and looked at his brain, sure enough, all of the pathways were fried. They were destroyed, and he had relearned how to be a human being via new pathways, which is pretty exciting. So anyway, a lot of wide open frontier out there in our brains, and I'm glad to know some people are working on it. And this guest is less so one of them now, because he's also a really funny comedian and pursuing that, but he stays up to speed in the neuroscience world. We're having some Sculpin IPA from Ballast Point Brewing, because he's originally from San Diego. Here's my chat with John O'Zalay.
Are we recording, by the way?
Yeah, we can be.
Or whatever. I just try to
like get some levels early and things like that. So
because you know, Star Wars has been so salient recently. I was talking with some friends about like George Lucas and like his, you know, vision and like how creative he was in creating the whole universe that we all know and love. But even in the originals, like he was trying to like prequelize them. He just didn't have the technology.
Like,
because he was very creative with like the graphics and the tech. Because like when we went back and like when he remastered them in the late 90s, right before the prequels came out, and like added scenes to them with the CGI with the same graphics he used for the prequels, mm-hmm. everyone was like, "Okay, cool, but why did you add those?" And they didn't really add much to the thing, and they were actually kind of distracting, mm-hmm. and they added nothing to the story, and so like he was limited and you could see, like, because he wrote and directed the first A New Hope, I think, and then gave off directing to Irving Kirshner and then someone else for Jedi for the second and third installments of the original. And, like, those were the best, of course. Like, everyone loves Jedi and Empire way, like, as their favorite Star Wars episodes. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote and directed all of the prequels.
Oh, weird. So it was that sort of thing of...
He had the monolithic control, and like, because he had all that, and there was nothing keeping him in check, like, saying, like, "Oh, you should actually hit this and that, or that," whatever, it ruined it, because he just had no feedback from anyone else. Like, there's probably a happy medium between, like, getting feedback from people and, like, having a creative vision.
Yeah.
That, like, even amazing, like, innovative... movie makers, filmmakers like George Lucas have to have someone in keeping them in check.
It's a weird thing to like acknowledge about yourself, but it was stand up and, you know, you sit around and you might write with people and sometimes like just nothing syncs up. You know, if you're a joke writer and someone has a tagline, like, "Let me use it," that's great.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're a storyteller or if you're just kind of like a, I don't know, whatever you do, puns, or you're clever, or mm-hmm. you're kind of very self-deprecating, or it's all very personal, maybe then it doesn't make sense when people go, "You should do this as a tag." You're like, no. It's not.
What percentage of tags do you use? When someone goes like, "Hey, I thought of this for the end of that joke, if you want to use it."
Yeah, I've done it a couple times. Pretty rarely. If I do it, it's usually for a joke I have going that I like believe in. I feel mm-hmm. pretty good about. It's, you know, I wouldn't do that with a joke like, "Oh, I'm just trying this out." If someone asks me, I go, "I must not have something here." But if I get in like and every now and again it comes up in something where I'm like, "Oh, how did I not see that? That's embarrassing. Like, that was a really good line."
Yeah. Yeah, like there's only been, I think, like maybe two or three tags that I've ever used that were, like, I maintain and like what I would consider my act mm-hmm. that like made it to the A-list material. And they were great. And like the I guess the trick is like having them be like still in your voice or whatever. Cause like every time, like a lot of times you'll hear a tag from someone, it's like, "Oh, that's just how you would do my joke."
Yeah, of course.
And that's not from my point of view. And you're like completely off base. I'm not trying to go there.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I'm that way for everyone else when I give them tags. Cause I'll think of a tag and be like, "This is going to fix this guy's joke or this gal's joke. And I'm going to help this person." And then they probably hear me like, "Oh my God, that's a really great idea." And then in the back of their head, they're like, "No."
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Jono, but no thanks. I'm not going to make it all weird and sciencey.
I don't think I could attack something like Vince Gilligan did, and so many episodes directed by other people and a whole writing team. And I think that's, you know, the fact that he gets credit for like creating it, and but I think he's the first to deflect it and go like, well, there was a lot of people that created the whole run of the show. And I feel like when, if ever I have an idea for, you know, I'll draw like a comic book, or I'll draw or write out like, this is what I see happening in this show, or, you know, if I'm pitching an idea. Mm-hmm. But then I always want to say, like, in the meeting, and then they go, where would ideas come from? I'm like, oh, well, get a writing team. Like, it's not going to be me. I'm not going to create all of this. And I did a web series once, and I was prepared to do that. Like, oh, I'll come up with everything. That'll be fun.
Right.
And I was totally into that, because, like, animation and short little clips, absolutely. Like, but when you get into hours of entertainment, I mean, that's insane to think you could do that on. I can't even really think of anyone who has done that.
I mean, you could say like Louis, with like the way he has all of the control of like writing, directing,
you
acting.
Know, but I think I just thought of a better example, J.K. Rowling. Like that whole giant world is pretty much hers. So writers probably do that, you know.
No.
But even with like Game of Thrones, outside of the books
But Tolkien. Did she like, she didn't write the movies, did she?
No, and that's the same thing with Game of Thrones. Like, HBO does it differently than the books, but, you know, Lord of the Rings, the same thing. Okay, those are, I guess when you have your own time and you just kind of like, and it's not, that maybe the visual component is what makes it like you have to have a team. You have to have people going, no, if you make the Ents look like this, it's going to throw people off. They can't, they've got to be tree-like, but they've got to move like this. And I think you couldn't just have one person drawing it, doing it, making the sound for it. It's just too many components.
Yeah, that is a lot to ask.
All right, I've solved it enough to satisfy myself. I feel pretty good about.
Well, I think, because those are distinctive jobs as well. Like, you have to have, you know, not just artistic vision, but a technical background and all of that stuff. Like that, I always get really mad at the coaches of professional sports teams that are also the GM of the team.
Yeah,
like what hubris do you
think? But then they do it well sometimes.
I don't think give me an example.
Belichick.
Belichick's not the GM.
He has a like control over personnel.
He has input, but he's not like actively scouting people. Like like the coach / GM has rarely worked out where like that's someone's full-time job normally.
I completely get
so
that.
Like to say that like, oh, I can do a very demanding job and also someone else's demanding job at the same time is a little much. Like the Doc Rivers does it for the Clippers, is not working out. But Chip Kelly for the Eagles, not working out. Like, of course you should have a good working relationship, like the same way that like a director and writing team would for a show. Like, you know, like, but while a director is like trying to fix a scene from a visual standpoint, there should be someone in a writer's room somewhere else fixing it from a writing standpoint.
Like the way on a set, a director has already sort of pre-set all the day's actions. Production meetings the day before or a week before. When we get here to this location, I want to set up a camera here. The DP knows what's going on. Everyone kind of, and then the director can kind of just be still and watch things. And they don't have, I know in the movies they're usually yelling with a megaphone, but that's not really how some people do that. But you've got your like assistant director who's yelling all that stuff out, and the director's just kind of, and I think you need that. You need someone that has like, well, I want this show or this book or this movie to go here, but I need a team around me to kind of orchestrate that. Mm-hmm. And if you're a coach that wants personnel decisions, it would make sense to go, I need a player that's about this big, that runs about this fast, that can do these things. And then they'd go, here are five guys that we've scouted. That's our job. And then you'd go, I like this guy the best. They go, all right, we'll get him.
Right.
And so I think that's to me, just without a lot of like research to that, it makes the most sense, you know?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, like you don't want your GM like drafting a running quarterback if you want someone who's just a pocket passer.
Yeah, yeah.
To use the sports metaphor again,
sports plays into a lot of stuff. That I know people like try to disassociate from it and kind of, I just don't want sports in my life. Uh-huh. I get that. But there are a lot of similarities to franchises, corporate structures.
Absolutely. I use it for metaphors all the time. Like in my science podcast, mm-hmm. University, I don't know if it's too clear soon to plug my...
Not at all. University with you and the Joes.
Joe Zimmerman and Raj Sivaraman.
Oh, not the Joes. Yeah, that's right. Raj. Sorry.
It's all right. He forgives you on my behalf. So like in that, we use like, because Joe went to Davidson and so did Steph Curry, the mm-hmm. basketball star for the Golden State Warriors, who's like reigning MVP. We use him as an example in like every other episode. Like we were doing one with like a quantum entanglement of like a photon, or I think it was a helium atom actually, about like how time might dilate on a quantum level based on how they're manipulating this experiment, and we use Steph Curry as like the example of how that might work, where like if Steph Curry is doing one thing, then Seth Curry, his brother, might be doing something else somewhere else, and it just kind of is our go-to way of explaining things, because that's just how we see it in, because so sports are so like, I don't know, if you watch and follow sports, they are, you know, a good structural microcosm of, you know, competition.
Completely.
Organizations. Yeah. It's, you know, a very tangible way to construct mm-hmm. a thought.
I think, you know, chess is probably the more sophisticated thing, but it doesn't have things outside of the players both on the board and yeah. manipulating them. So imagine if there were a whole bench on either side of people that could be subbed in and someone mm-hmm. controlling that chess team and going, get a new bishop
yeah,
in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, exactly. I would say that like you could, like sports and chess, like you could probably say chess is a sport.
Mm-hmm.
Just like with the strategy and like the way you deploy play. Like, if you're like thinking of yourself as the players, as coaches, and you're using, you know, your individual pieces as players and like the way that you use them,
mm-hmm.
role players, as it were.
Well, let's get into it then. How you did get into science and sports and chess? And first, how are you enjoying this? What is this? Allagash? Yeah, Sculpin. No,
oh,
this is
yeah, Ballast Point.
Ballast Point. You're from San Diego.
I am.
So I got this Sculpin IPA.
Yeah, they name all their beers after fishes.
I know. I almost got a Grunion Pale Ale because you said you like pale ales or India
IPA,
pale ales.
Yes.
And the picture on the front of this one I thought was a little bit more charming than the Grunion.
Yes.
It's pretty good though, right?
Mm-hmm.
I like it. I think they do a nice job at that Ballast Point.
Very popular.
So I think you're the first person who's been on this particular podcast who was also on Blast Off.
Hey, crossover.
First major crossover. And so people that are familiar with that would know your backstory of getting into comedy and a PhD in neuroscience mm-hmm. and I would doubt that people remember that lineage completely.
Every episode and which one it was.
Yeah, yeah. It's like watching a movie years ago. They go, oh, yeah. right, I know this guy. And I know you, and I've heard this story, and I still don't really...
Yeah.
I don't remember how you... Because you spent some time in Seattle, and then... Or we met when I was like doing a gig in Seattle or something like that?
I think we overlapped in Seattle one weekend.
Okay.
But I think we met actually at UCB at the one of the very last... comedy Bang Bangs.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. That's
like,
right.
Yeah, like the old stand-up show that like spun off into a TV series and never needed to do a live show ever again. Yeah, and you hosted that show that I was on. Or no, I hosted it, and you were like the headliner on it, basically.
Okay. That seems so weird.
And like, that's when you saw that I was used to be a scientist, and where you mm-hmm. connected over that.
And then, so the Seattle thing, you just maybe like a week or something later, we're going to be up there and I was going to be there or something.
Right, yeah, we overlapped in our travels.
So really only San Diego is pertinent to your evolution as a person.
Yeah, and Southern California in general. I mean, I went to school at Santa Barbara for college, and it was during college that I'd like tried my first open mic, and I didn't start it like comedy earnestly until I moved back to San Diego
mm-hmm.
After college in like 2005-ish.
Yeah, I did a similar thing where I would call the comedy club in Denver because I went to school an hour north of there, and always consider driving the hour to do an open mic and wait in line, but I was just like, yeah. the gas money, the time, add that to like nerves about it. It would yeah. always talk me out. And then I think I could reconcile it. Maybe this is as a science-minded person of like, I got to get this stuff all out of the way, and then I'll really dive into this other thing. Is that how you were?
What do you mean by this stuff out of the way?
Which like college. Thing? College. Like studying and having like something to really care about. Like, well, I've yeah. got to like, I got to focus on this and get this done with, and then I can just go be a child.
It depends, because Santa Barbara, at the time at least, did not have any comedy scene. There wasn't a comedy show that I knew of, at least.
Yeah.
There was like a coffee shop open mic for people to play their acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
Singer-songwriter songs. And I think I tried comedy at one of those a couple of times, but the first open mic was at the Comedy Store in San Diego during a summer that I was home. I was like, ooh, stand-up comedy is really fun. I should try it even when I'm back at school. And I was like, nah, I don't want to, because there's no like real comedy scene there. And I would have probably, if it was like convenient, I didn't have a car, so I couldn't get around.
Yeah.
So if it was in like my town, I probably would have pursued it. But because college, as much as I liked it, I didn't take it ultra seriously
yeah.
until grad school, weirdly, after I started comedy. But yeah, like, because Santa Barbara is just a resort town where everyone's laid back and chilling out. It's, yeah. At least... That was my experience where it was just like,
and that's not great for comedy, even if they had a scene there.
No. Like, yeah, I probably would have blown off certain shows like to go play schlosh ball, kickball in with beer on a park somewhere.
Yeah.
It was too much. It was like, looking back, I was like, I would slap myself. Just like, go do something with your life. Like, get your shit together. Like, quit but having so much fun. You're going to have fun later.
But you, like, are still pretty young, and you've been out of your PhD program for a few years, pretty mm-hmm. much since I've known you.
Right.
So how did you blaze through grad school and straight into getting mm-hmm. your doctorate? And you did that all in Santa Barbara?
No. So Santa Barbara, I graduated in 2004, and then I moved to San Diego, back to San Diego in 2005. And
so what are the lengths of these? Undergrad, 4 years?
Undergrad, 4 years. Then for a year and a half, I was in San Diego, and I was like, maybe once every week, maybe once every 2 weeks doing an open mic mm-hmm. at the comedy. Because it was a lottery. That was like how sad the comedy scene was in like that era of our history in San Diego, was that like it was a lottery open mic at the San Diego La Jolla Comedy Store.
The weird thing is that I had scooted out of there just a year or two. Like I left there in 2004.
Okay.
So right just ahead of
we
that.
We just missed each other?
We just missed each other. And I probably got out just before it became an explode. Like there were usually right. 30 of us. Sometimes it'd be yeah. less and there's a little bit more. But it wasn't to a lottery point at that. Or yeah, it was. Yeah, sometimes people would get sent home and I didn't get a spot. But
right. Yeah, so every Sunday like at 7 p.m., like they'd do an hour of an open mic before like their normal show. And it was, they'd try to fit as many people on as they could. So they'd do like 3 minutes, or like 20, 15 people probably with a little host in between that would do 3 minutes. So like you could feasibly sign up and not get on for 3 minutes. So I would get on like on average maybe 2-3 weeks a month and do 3 minutes a piece to like just other comics
mm-hmm.
and get it just growing so little, if at all, probably going backwards
yeah
in experience. Until like,
because I remember there being people there. I mean, I always felt
there was like people. It was technically a bringer. Like you were supposed to bring two people. I never did. They were not very strict about it because yeah. it was an open mic or whatever. And like there was definitely people there. I think they were mostly comics or just friends of comics who didn't want to pay attention to anyone else.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like the kind of bringer that like will work at certain clubs. Like that one. It's like a big enough room where like they never sat it right enough mm-hmm. to where it felt like a show, at least from my recollection. I just remember bombing the whole time. I'm just making excuses for how poorly I did, probably. Where I'd like do my 3 minutes and get maybe one laugh,
yeah,
if that. And just I have no idea how I kept going, but yeah.
It's weird that I realize this is you're the first comedian I've had on the show too. And I always wonder or worry that in podcasting, like comedians talking to comedians about comedy.
Oh yeah, we're gonna lose really, people.
It's been treaded.
Sure, yeah.
But it is interesting, like to be doing that mm-hmm. while still gainfully sort of pursuing something that you weren't like half in, half out. You were going to school. You're and you're at San Diego State?
No, no, no. At San Diego, I was just working at a biotech company, and I hated it. And
but you, oh, so you were out of school for a while before
I was
you...
out of school. I took a year and a half off,
mm-hmm.
Or like I had graduated. I didn't know what I wanted to do at that point. I just moved back to San Diego.
Oh, okay.
And I was just kind of
then the open mics began. Yeah, that makes sense. Those things always have to coincide. I didn't really know what I was doing.
Yeah. So the most I didn't know what I was doing is when I do at open mics and had no perspective to bring. Everyone must have been very patient to put up with me back then. Yeah, so I came back to San Diego, year and a half. I was working at a biotech lab, and like I hated it, but I liked science, and I just wanted to use my brain more than just as like mixing chemicals together. So I went to, you know, apply to a research degree at several schools in cities where I could do stand up.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied to Boston University, got in there. And moved there like in 2006.
Oh, okay. But so you didn't like the biotech company, but you liked research.
Yes.
And you, so I've heard the joke, and you've talked about like giving cocaine to mice.
Rats.
Rats, sorry.
I'll never forgive you.
Why mice? Mites, though, they're crack addicts, not cocaine.
Yeah, come on.
Damn it.
Get it right.
But like in biotech, I mean, that is your that's your specimen a lot of time is a mammal or, and you felt fine doing that?
What do you mean?
Like giving cocaine to a rodent or.
Oh, like it wasn't like, you mean like the animal testing ethical element to it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's certainly like, it crossed my mind. But like when I worked in the biotech company, we would use like animal blood or whatever serum they called it, but it was just like purified proteins. Like it wasn't like they were chopping their heads off and draining their blood in front of me, but like we would use like, you know, et cetera compounds that they would like, you know, drain the blood from other animals or like take a blood sample essentially.
Mm-hmm. and what had you gotten?
So I knew like how like down the road, like even though we weren't dealing with animals directly in the biotech company, I saw like how they had medical applications like directly.
Mm-hmm.
Cause we were like purifying proteins to like use in certain treatments or diagnosing heart disease or et cetera.
And how you do, what are the steps there? You get this blood and then you apply it to, you like mix it in with.
Oh, they would use like basically use, certain immunochemistry procedures. Do you know how that works at all?
Not even remotely.
Okay. Well,
if I'm guessing,
yeah,
amino chemistry procedures. Let's see. I've heard all those words on this show already.
Yeah,
and I would guess that you've got that blood, you've got that sweet blood, and then you've got some amino acids. So you've got a bit of a DNA structure.
You're nailing on the head. All these buzzwords—they're like ringing up.
And then you splash a little blood in there and see if those things are in any way compatible, and then. I have no working knowledge of how any sort of molecular biology works or that chemistry involved. I don't know what is supposed to be happening between the cells and like, are they allowing this blood in? What is the blood meant to do? I don't know. So please give me some insight as to what's going on there.
All right. So generally speaking, like if you're trying to look for a specific compound in like a human blood sample, for instance, like let's say there's a goat and a cow that you kind of use to double up to make it easily detectable. What you do is take the blood from a goat, put it into a cow, and the cow is like senses that that's something else, some foreign substance in their bloodstream. They're going to build antibodies to that.
Hey, there's cow's blood in here.
Yes, to that like goat basically. So so like it's basically building this chain reaction of antibodies on antibodies on antibodies. They keep putting that same compound into different animals until like they're building these giant antibodies that are now detectable.
Wait. You go cow blood into goat, that combo into buffalo, that combo into sheep.
Yep.
And these
into platypus.
Who thought of this? And then what do you have by the end? What do you put that into?
So then you react it with like whatever you're kind of looking for. So if you're looking for a specific...
Wait,
like,
can I go back one step before that?
Mm-hmm.
You've got the blood of the cow and the goat, and it's in its stream.
Mm-hmm.
What are we extracting there? We're taking a syringe and we're taking out this blood that's a combination of both, and then we have this structure of both bloods, but sort of...
Well, they separately, you know, centrifuge it.
Oh, okay.
So they separate the blood into different, you know, densities, essentially.
And which most animals have a slightly different density.
Okay. Exactly. So they'll extract the antibodies based after they've centrifuged everything, so they can take the immunocells, the ones that are reacting to this blood, and extract them specifically.
And those are the things that comprise essentially an antibody.
Yeah. So those are markers. Like you're doing like an analytics test. So and then if you put like AIDS or whatever into the HIV virus into one of these people, they'll also develop antibodies to that. So like it keeps going until you can like actually detect, like find, have a giant antibody compound that detects specifically HIV or something.
So when they say, you know, they bring back, like, I only know this through like the limited amount of medical shows I've seen, but like, well, your markers for this are pretty good. Mm-hmm. And they are kind of, the blood has essentially tried to develop its own defense, mm-hmm. but it doesn't really know what it's doing. It's just kind of creating what, new cells or new aminos to kind of, we think this will stop this cow's blood from permeating through our system, or is that what your body's kind of trying to do?
Sort of, yeah. In fact, like most of the diseases we test for, we don't test for the actual disease. We test for our reaction to the disease. Mm-hmm. So that's why, like, when you get tested for HIV, they say like it takes like 6 weeks for it to show up, because like that it's in your body the whole time. It just takes a certain amount for it to take an effect.
Yeah,
and that's either our antibodies to it or our lack of it. Like,
so when they look and they say your white blood cell count is really low,
yes, or you have a specific antibody to that virus.
Oh, that's interesting. That, what a weird way to look at it. It's like playing Battleship or something, where it's kind of like, oh, we don't know what's in there, but mm-hmm. your body's reacting to something.
Yeah, it's the shadow of something. It's the same way that they like discovered the quote unquote God particle, the Higgs boson. They didn't just like look under a microscope and see the actual Higgs boson. They just saw the shadow of it. Mm-hmm. They say like, if it exists, it will project this like blip in our data.
Yeah.
And that's what they saw. It's like, oh crap, that blip's there. It's there. We can't see it.
And then you have to do that enough times where you're like, this mm-hmm. is exactly what we predicted. This weird kind of blip shadow graph.
Yeah, that must have been like, it's such a weird anticlimactic way of discovering something so fundamental, is just like 100,000 repetitions of a specific experiment, and then like you only once you run the statistical software, you're like, oh yeah, I guess we did find it.
I love when they show photos of that, of all these people gathered behind, and it's always a very like ethnically and age diverse group of people,
uh-huh.
and they're all just raising fists in the air, uh-huh. and knowing that they all just peeked over someone's shoulder and saw the tiniest, most insignificant thing.
Go team! Yeah. Wow. Did you see like how like NASA reacted when the Mars rover landed?
I've seen some of those with the high fiving.
Yeah, yeah. They were live streaming it, and I was watching it at one point, and like all these dorks in polo shirts and laminates in like a control room were like all looking in, and they finally like I don't even think they're watching a video feed. They just like heard, like saw the data scroll on the screen. They were like, "We did it!" And they're all jumping and high fiving.
To be a part of that, though.
Oh yeah, no, yeah,
it's great.
Yeah.
That would feel great.
It's like winning the Super Bowl for them, going back to science.
Yeah, it all comes back to sports. And then, so you're pursuing your PhD, or this is grad school where you're doing research. You're mm-hmm. like, I'll go to grad school, but I want to experiment on these rats.
Right.
But mostly blood, something to do with...
No, I didn't. That was like, I was just, like the blood was the example I used for like the practical application of animal research.
I see. Okay.
So like I realized that animal research is a pretty essential part of like the medical and scientific community.
Yeah. So you want to save people. You care.
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. And I want to save everything in general. And I also don't want to cause harm. Like,
but you're not afraid to break some eggs. You like omelets.
Sure. Okay. Absolutely. I'm not a vegetarian. I have dominion over the beasts of the field.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, so I studied rats specifically for in a cocaine abuse model of that research.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at learning and memory and how they learn to get off cocaine. So the potentially...
Wait, can we go back to transitioning from the markers and looking at the blood mm-hmm. to then how do you scale up from there? Is it kind of just like, you got that figured out, you understand mm-hmm. antibodies and markers, now let's move on.
Right, well, I didn't use any of that in grad school.
Oh, that was just...
That was just like how I'd interacted with animals research beforehand. Like, I was in a different step of it. I just... Mm-hmm. That was just like I can reconcile working with animals because I know they are used for good.
I see. Okay.
It wasn't just like, oh, we're torturing animals for no reason.
And to people listening who might be clenching a steering wheel, or I can assure you, Jono's a thoughtful, delightful, pleasant person. It yeah. feels nice to, you know, it's easy to get caught up in big pharmaceutical companies mm-hmm. doing these things for only harm, but there are medical implications a majority of the time where these things are totally viable and necessary.
Right, and there's a reason we do it on rats and not, like, exclusively primates, mm-hmm. you know, like, because, like, that's the most, you know, translatable model mammal to us is like a primate of some sort, and they do research on that, but only as like a last step.
Yeah.
So like they will do it on the lowest like form of life possible until it's absolutely necessary to make it up the way to like even human research.
Yeah.
So like, you know, if you could test, you know, on a worm, you would, or whatever. If the implication is like translatable, it's just like. The rats are like this, like they're like the rats. The reason there's so many lab rats and lab mice, et cetera, is because rodents are at a very specific portion of like, they are smart enough for their brain capacity to like sort of translate into humans, but they're low enough to where we like don't care if we kill them.
Yeah.
Like if they are pests in your home and you're setting traps for them, like, do you care if I'm feeding them cocaine?
I read this study where cereal companies were taking a lot of grief because of this is prior to the sugar thing, but it was more about mm-hmm. fat. Mm-hmm. And these scientists were, you know, partly at the time, like their funding was paid for, like their research was paid for by these big food conglomerates. Mm-hmm. And yet they were like just so curious about the effects of fat, you know, fat in a diet. So they just fed these chimps for like a calendar year as these really disgusting fatty diets, but they all lived. They were all fine. Yeah. They didn't get like noticeably, you know, terrible blood pressure or cholesterol or anything. It was, there's something about that with science too. Just that whole other element of like, yeah, but I gotta know. Like, why I gotta know what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, that's why there's like so many protocols, like the amount of paperwork you had to file just like to justify the reason we needed to research that. They don't just like willy-nilly say, oh yeah, let's see a monkey get fat. there has to be an application for what you're trying to research.
So something with like cocaine and mice, I know there were brain scans that kind of showed similarities between like Alzheimer's and if you take a bunch of cocaine and like the dopamine levels or something kind of deplete that part of your brain.
Sure. Yeah.
Is that something you can justify and go, here's what we're going to look at? And they go, yep, here's all your funding.
Mm-hmm. Like we have to say, like, show our previous research and why we need to continue researching it, and also justify new research based on other people's research. It's like,
yeah.
Oh, this lab down in North Carolina found that if you give rats cocaine, they'll murder their friends. And like we say, like, oh, based on that, we need to test if, you know, they can get off of it.
So, but when you're doing it, is there a thing where, well, just in your studying, I mean, is this, I'm going to go to grad school and I kind of pick and choose, or I'm in this program and this is just a step that every student goes through? I mean, how much of it is you saying, here's where I want to have an expertise, here's where I want to focus?
I studied when I was an undergrad, mm-hmm. I studied biopsychology. That was the name of it. It's basically neuroscience by a different name. And the topic that I found most interesting, which is probably determined by my professor, actually, like I just found one professor really compelling, was like drugs of abuse. And I was like, oh, that is a fascinating topic, mm-hmm. because like, why do we take them in the first place? And why do we let them control our lives?
Yeah, yeah.
If we are addicts, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of was just sort of fascinated by that elements. Like, and that's what I did some undergraduate projects based on that, and that had like some experience in the laboratory setting for that specific type of procedure. That was like the logical next step of like, oh, I'm interested in this, I will apply to research in that field.
Yeah.
And I will look attractive to prospective professors based on this skill set I have and my interest in it. Mm-hmm. And so that's just what happened. It was like the natural progression.
You did that little pause after who you'd look attractive to, and could have subbed in anybody there.
It's mostly I was burping because of this delicious Sculpin.
It is good. Yeah, I like it. yeah, an IPA. I like them, I guess. I don't think yeah. I seek them out all the time, but
I do get a little annoyed about the I've always liked, not always, but I grew to like IPAs in my mid-20s, and now craft beers are a real thing.
Yeah.
And there was, and you see it on dating profiles now. It's I'm all about whiskey and IPAs and adventures and hiking.
Yeah, yeah.
They name IPAs specifically.
Yeah.
It's okay, you like beer, great.
The weird thing is that craft thing too is Colorado and San Diego surprisingly stocked with breweries.
It's weird. You can't go to a city where they don't brag about their craft beer scene, though.
It's a little bit of that. Because I've been doing it through, for this podcast, I'll find out where people are from and then try to find beer from that area. There are certain places where they don't have a ton of at least exported beer. And then when I get online and start looking, Connecticut, as far as I know, doesn't have a significant amount of beer that they create.
Connecticut doesn't have anything now. Let's put it in perspective. They have wrestling. That's the headquarters of WWE.
Ah,
and they have Sports Center.
They have
ESPN.
It.
The ESPN headquarters are in Bristol, Connecticut. And they have insurance companies and a lot of crime.
But I remember going in college to brewery tours and stuff, and it wasn't here's our amber, here's our pilsner, here's our lager. So and maybe there was an ale, but I don't even remember a pale ale being that specific, let alone an IPA.
Yeah. No, they really caught on. I remember first trying IPAs, and I thought it tasted cologne smells.
Yeah.
I was whoa, spice, a little much, a little heavy on the spice there. Take it back a notch.
Well, I guess that ties into, what compelled you to, what gave you I've been around significant amount of substance abuse. I think it lives in me, my brain chemistry, me and family members when I were younger, of our generation had to be hey, let's be on the lookout for these things because these live in us.
We gotta be on the lookout.
So do you feel you're going to knock on the monster's door a little bit by experimenting or looking in? Or what if you don't find anything? Is that scarier? Or would you rather find this little nugget that goes, this is it. This is the key that makes people more susceptible to addiction? Or what are you looking for in the brain?
What I looked for specifically was a sort of laboratory approximation of a treatment technique.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't looking about what makes them addicted. I was looking at a potential way to help people not be addicted anymore. Because what we don't realize is when we're taking our drugs of choice, our either beer, marijuana, cocaine, heroin, what have you.
Nail polish removal.
Exactly. Huffing all the good stuff. You're building associative memories that you're not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
So where you do it, who you're with, sights and sounds, all of those things are now, because your memory works in a specific way where it remembers the things that are emotionally evocative, being, in a high state, you're whoa, I'm having a great time, I'm going to remember this forever. And not just the semantic memory of I went to this bar and we had so much fun and we high-fived and I had sex with this person.
The party never stops. That's what they always say in AA and stuff.
Of course. So in addition to all those actual events that are happening, there's a lot of associations you're building out of context.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in a bar, I remember this because blah, blah, blah. And then you're just building all these associative memories that you're not aware of because they're all subconscious.
Yeah.
So the problem that addicts have is when they try to quit, when they know they have a problem, they're going to have all these triggers.
Yeah, I can't go to bars now.
Yeah.
I can't see people drink around me.
Of course. Yeah. So they'll have these cravings and then they'll relapse or whatever. So because as soon as they have the one, they're on a downward spiral again.
Mm-hmm.
So what we were looking at was how to get people to stop associating all those cues and contexts with that actual drug by exposing them to those environments without the drug and then seeing what brain regions were responsible for learning to no longer associate it.
I just pictured you sending someone in with one of those brain helmets into a bar just to pretend to be normal. Just act like everything's fine. You want a beer, Steve? What's on your head? And that person sorry.
Remember the thing that Doc Brown wears at the beginning of Back to the Future, and the giant light bulbs that are coming out of a giant helmet.
That's kind of what I pictured as this person trying to fit in. And I'm good, man. I don't really need a beer. I'm all right.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I don't normally care so much about personal things, but I do think it's fascinating because you have the same operating system that the person you're looking at has. We have a human brain, you know, a primate's brain. Was there something you look back on growing up, like, well, I was introduced to drugs and alcohol this way, and therefore maybe I had that fun summer at the lake and I drank a bunch, mm-hmm. But I never developed where, like, I was sneaking beers, or is that how you would think about things? Like, well, here's my interpretation of my own relationship with it.
Not really, actually. Like, I looked at it much more just from an academic perspective, because I never got into any drugs other than drinking. Mm-hmm. And even my drinking was pretty moderate. And it was mostly context specific, I guess. Like, if I'm hanging out at a bar and at a comedy show, like, I'll occasionally want to drink beer more than if I was just hanging out at some other venue.
So if you go to maybe a concert or something, someone says, you want a beer? And then pretty soon someone goes, I'll get the next one. And now all of a sudden you're locked into this thing like, oh, we're five people. That's five beers. I don't want to buy beers for five people. And two, I don't want to like agree that we're all just going to keep lapping around. And yet sometimes that happens.
Sure.
And so when you're there, you just go, no, I'm good. I'm just going to kind of watch the concert. I'm fine.
Well, now like I kind of pick and choose days that I don't drink. Because as stand-up comics, you're at a bar or something that serves beer at a comedy show every night of the week.
It's tied into your payment a lot of times.
Yeah,
you get a couple meals and you get as many drinks as you want.
Yeah, that is technically part of the... Thank God the IRS doesn't make me declare drink tickets, because that would be most of my income.
You certainly had a lot of nachos free.
I should be able to deduct the tips I put in every time I get a drink ticket. Like, it is those things where it's like, if I had a different job, mm-hmm. if I was just a writer, if I was writing at home all day or writing for in a writing room all day and then went home and just stayed home, I would probably drink two nights a week.
But see, then you meet writers who do it, and they, I've had a tough day. The whole, like, my dogs are barking. And I don't mean to say, like, just write. That's everyone. Like, it's hard to work. It's hard to come home. And sure. It's easy to come home. And I just want to sit down for a second. And it feels real good to have something.
And if that is the case, like, that home and that feeling become their association, where it's like, oh, I'm tired. I've had a long day. I'm at home, the place I drink beer.
Right, yeah.
That is, I am having a craving that I'm not even aware why I have one.
So I guess from, like, science is always so, I don't know, attractive in that capacity, in that, like, you're not within it kind of looking out going, how do I get out of this? You're examining it, meaning it doesn't matter what your feelings are toward an addict or someone who displays those behaviors, whether you do that or do not, you still are able to examine it and go, what's happening here and why is this happening?
Right.
But do you sometimes kind of go, would it help if you identified with one or the other, someone who didn't drink at all or someone who was a complete addict? Would that influence it or give you some benefit?
I don't really know, because like the way that the experiments are designed are so specific and based on almost logic rather than like, especially for animal experiments. Like for human ones, it might be a little bit different. When you have like a body of research and you're like, okay, this has been shown in this experiment beforehand, let's expand on this and test, you know, how it would try it a little bit differently or whatever. So it's more like a logic game and a puzzle, rather than like, I bet this happens because the rat feels insecure when he's not drinking around his other rat buddy. It's like, if I empathized with the rats as they're taking cocaine that they're self-administering, I don't think that would help me design this experiment any better, or, you know, process the numbers or anything like that. So I don't think in that specific case, it probably wouldn't help. But I'm sure that helps people get insights into other forms of research, like maybe more human, like specific.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, how often do you need to rely on a sociologist to say, well, people with these typical types of childhoods, with this trauma, with this whatever, tend to have these buttons. And if those are pushed with this brain, and then could you look at it and say, like, this person, given this brain that I've seen it respond to stimuli, I know for sure they're never going to be an alcoholic or never be addicted to drugs. Is that possible?
You know, it's actually, like, thinking more about it, there are insights in drug abuse that have been gleaned from humanity and down into the, like, and then translated down to the rats that they tested, like, a theory basically. So remember like the crack epidemic in like the 80s?
Yeah, I'm familiar.
Yes.
New Jack City? You kidding me?
Everyone was like very, you know, panicked. They were like, oh my God, there's, you know, crack. It's so addictive. Look at what it's doing. Just destroying our inner cities. As soon as they get one of our white kids addicted to it in the suburbs, it's going to take over the suburbs too.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God, our poor, precious white children. and everyone was like, oh my God, it's just this addicting substance or whatever. And then that never happened. It just never made its way. It just, you know, pretty much stayed in the inner cities in a specific type of demographic of people.
Yeah.
And what they studied is like, it's not just the drug itself that has an effect like that. Otherwise, people would try it and get addicted to it. So like, what else is going on? And what they found is like, they did a rat study where we actually did this in my lab as well. It's called environmental enrichment. So like, they would have rats that like had a much more pleasant home environment. So they'd have toys, they'd have a wheel to get exercise,
yeah,
and then friends to hang out with.
I've heard of this because when people bring
park,
up, yeah, rat park.
Rat park. So like, they had like a little, the rats were having a much more full home life. So they're much more fulfilled on the inside. And that's like those natural reinforcers of like having friends, getting exercise, mentally stimulated.
Yeah.
All of those things were flooding their brain with the same kinds of chemicals, not necessarily specifically the kinds of dopamine rush that a cocaine can give.
I'm so high right now.
But like, we're yeah, flying a kite they're getting together. Natural reinforcers in the same sort of pleasure centers that like cocaine activates, so that they've already had like those, you know, they're already high, a natural high, and then when they take cocaine, it's like not giving them that much extra.
Yeah.
So like, why am I giving myself this horrible hangover and whatever if I just am getting only a little bit better, or not even really? So it's that like kind of human observation or rat observation. I don't know how exactly they designed it, but they definitely found.
I love the person that came up with it.
Yeah.
Like, listen, because I mean, it does seem ridiculous when you look at it, and it would be easy scientifically to go, I don't get it. We have this rat in a little square box. There's a mm-hmm. button. They can get cocaine. And or I heard it with the nicotine was similar too. Nicotine, yeah, whenever they want it. And yeah, they like it all the time. And then the first scientist that came in and went like, does this remind anyone of just someone in a terrible studio yeah. apartment? This is horrible. There are no right. windows in here.
Or like, even a jail cell. There's like horrible prison drug abuse stories, yeah, because there's nothing to stimulate their brain
mm-hmm.
in a natural way. So, of course, they turn to drugs. It's their one escape.
Yeah.
You know?
And why wouldn't it? I mean, drugs are fun. If you're not having fun, it's a way to buy some fun.
Yeah. Relief.
Yeah. Man, I've got so many more questions, but I'm nearly out of this delicious Sculpin, so why don't we take Same. A quick little break, and then we'll continue this chat with John Ozalay and a little bit more of the Ballast Point Sculpin India Pale Ale right after this. John Ozalay, pretty good dude. Fascinating guy, fun to talk to. Part two next week, and we'll get further into it. Continue that discussion with more delicious Ballast Point beer. Thanks for rating the show, subscribing, whatever, all those things that go into it. If you'd like to call in and be a part of the show, follow @space_cave. Again, the Junk Show is February 14th at the Copper Still. Hope to see you there in Los Angeles. And now let's get on out of here. This is some music from Los Angeles local band The Lonely Wild. Dave Farina, the drummer, has been a guest on the show. You know him. So now you are in some way familiar with the band. And here's more of their music. This is another one off of Chasing White Light. This is called Scar. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave. There's a scar on my arm from a fall on your bed. A broken doll. Cut me open, wide open red. Your family thread fell apart when daddy bought a new suit. A brand new girl on his arm. No one really seemed to alarm. Where was it she had to go? Pulling that heavy stone. Couldn't we have lightened the load? If I could spend the rest of my life thinking about the wrongs I could right, every moment I'm drawing.
before I found your bed. A broken doll, porcelain. You might as well have left you for dead. We grew up, you got lost, died alone in a tent. I wish that I knew you then. I wish I could have been your friend. She had to go, pulling that heavy stone. Could we have lightened the load? I could spend the rest of my life thinking about the wrongs I could right. Every moment I'm drawing a line. Where was it she had?